Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Flesh and Blood and Bone podcast. I am filmmaker Kira Gardner, and this is my special effects makeup artist, amazing dad, Tony Gardner.
I am Tony Gardner.
That's Tony Gardner. And today we bring you another episode on Mom and Dad Save the World.
Another obscure movie Alterian has worked on that no one has ever seen.
We're still hitting it with the 90s films, going a bit in order. I'm going to start going out of order of my dad's career here soon.
Find something interesting.
So that we can have more things to talk about. Just the early 90s, you know, there were hits in there. There were definitely hits in there. This was probably fun to work on.
If you look in this mirror, you'll see what you look like. Okay. Behind you is Tom, our camera operator. Today we'll be going around the set on Mom and Dad Save the World.
This was fun to work on, and the script was great, and the original edit was awesome and very enjoyable. It was written by the guys that wrote Bill and Ted. It had a lot of weird humor in it and weird stuff happening, and they filmed it. They had a screening actually in Woodland Hills.
Wow, which is where part of the movie takes place.
People were laughing so hard in some of the spots that you couldn't hear the dialogue for the next couple things. So they were figuring out that they needed to re-edit to put a pause in there so people could enjoy the movie. And then some genius executive went, you know, I took my kids to that screening and they really liked it. We should just re-edit this as a kids movie. And none of the humor was kids humor.
Yeah.
So all of the weird twisted stuff went away and it just ends up being a very basic storyline instead, unfortunately, which it takes a while to get going because the setup is just sort of like daily monotony and normal life and then things get weird. But the cool thing was, well, partially because it was the 90s, but everything's practical.
Yeah.
And the VFX are in the formative years.
They're figuring it out.
It's pretty obviously
basic. Didn't notice it at all. It was so good.
But the cast was amazing. Production design was brilliant. The original cut was really fun. It's one of those things where what you see on screen is not what
your experience
everybody
was.
Built. Yeah. So it was a bit jarring to see the final cut.
I imagine filming it was A, a lot of fun, and then B, set up for success, but then seeing it after the edit.
There were just so many raunchy jokes and weird things that played on the fact how people were so stupid and stuff like that. And it all just goes away for the simpler stuff.
For example, the dad in the movie, his name's Dick, and they use that to their advantage.
Quite a bit.
Quite a bit, and I would imagine even more so in the original cut.
Yeah. A lot of Earth Dick.
Yes, that's one of it's so weird. I was watching that and I knew my dad had said that the cut was reworked to be more for children, but then one of the end lines, the mom says something about Earth Dick.
Oh, Earth Dick.
And so I'm just like, okay, but they left that in as the ending note is Earth Dick. So it begs the question of who was choosing what stayed and what went.
Yeah, it's a mishmash.
For those of you who are unfamiliar with this movie, we will try and describe it for you a little bit.
Best part is the casting. I mean, it was Jeffrey Jones and Terry Garr as the husband and wife. John Lovitz was riding the peak of his career as the crazy guy on a lot of Saturday Night Live stuff. And they used him as the evil guy here. There's a lot of supporting characters that are really awesome. Wallace Shawn, Kathy Ireland, Dwyer Brown. A ton of people in it.
It's a star-studded cast, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, the script was really good. It really drew a lot of people in. But
what you see, if you've seen the movie, is a movie that follows this guy, Todd.
Evil Todd Spingo takes over the planet from Eric Idle, the benevolent ruler.
Yes.
And renames the planet, I think, Spingo.
Yeah, after his last name.
And puts his bust up everywhere, and he's just like the narcissistic ruler. And he's going to blow up Earth because he has a size issue, and Earth is bigger.
Yes.
So he decides to take it out, and then they're going to blow up, send a bomb to Woodland Hills, specifically a death ray that's going to blow up the whole planet. And they zoom in on Woodland Hills, and Todd Spengo sees Marge, which is Terry Garr exercising, aerobicizing.
Yes.
And falls immediately in love with her.
He's fascinated by her hip thrusts.
Yes. When Terry Garr and Jeffrey Jones are taking a vacation, they're leaving their kids behind for a weekend away, and they're going to go down this road to Ojai, and they get picked up in this tractor beam because Todd Spengo wants Marge for his own.
Mm-hmm.
They get sucked in their station wagon and on this tractor beam and end up on the planet.
Immediately, the guy, the dad, is taken to the brig.
Yeah, they separate Marge and the dad, and dad gets taken to basically a prison cell.
Where he meets a weird rat, which is what I'm dressed as.
Yes.
What the heck is that?
What the heck is that?
And he meets Eric Idle, who was the benevolent yet stupid king who was overthrown.
What did I just say?
I am Raph.
No, I am Raph. You are Earthdick.
And then Marge is invited to Todd Spengo's wedding, but isn't made aware of the fact she's the bride.
And then some things happen and some other things happen. Ultimately, she meets a lot of kooky characters along the way, some fish people, some dog people.
The helpers in the palace.
Yes, of the people of this palace that is a planet of quote-unquote, not my words, idiots, that all the guards are kind of dumb. The dad tries to make his way back to the mom to save her. You know, makes a a good attempt and then is thrown out a window and then meets some like people in the desert who used to be the main people of that planet until Todd came. And then they're wearing bird masks for some reason because they're so dumb. They think that if they dress like birds, they'll be disguised. And then the dad gets back and saves the mom, Trojan horse style, Trojan Todd style.
Mm-hmm.
Todd gets his comeuppance, and then the mom and dad get Eric Idle's character out of the brig, and then he takes ownership back over the planet, and he reverses the magnetizing beam that brought them to the planet in the first place, and they go back home in their crazy kooky outfits that they're now in from this crazy adventure, and they roll up to their house in Woodland Hills. And the kids come out and they're like, oh my gosh, you guys went to Santa Barbara and that's what happened? And they're like, yeah, crazy, I know. And then it ends with them gonna have sex on the roof. That's how that ends. That ends. They're on the roof and they're drinking champagne and then they start macking out and then the camera tilts up to the sky and then she goes, ugh, Earth Dick. And there then it go. Ends. So that's the movie.
Is it for kids? Is it for grown-ups?
We don't know. I think the people who made it don't know. But that's okay.
It's interesting looking at the credits because it's Warner Brothers, HBO, Cinema Plus, a whole bunch of people in the kitchen on this one. And Greg Beeman was the director. And after we finished this, Greg Beeman was going to do Super Mario Brothers as a live-action movie.
Oh, my God. I just found out that that existed.
Oh, yeah.
It looks insane.
Yeah, we got really far into it based on the work that was done on Mom and Dad Save the World. They really liked that whole Dr. Seuss vibe, weird world, and they wanted to do Super Mario Brothers. And we had done those mushrooms.
Oh, my God.
You know, so it's like there were a whole bunch of things that kind of like crossed over. So we got to the point where we were like building characters for it, and it got canned, and then it got rebooted as a dark sci-fi comedy with Bob Hoskins, one of the people in the production office who was the production designer, Patrick Tatopoulos, who's also a creature effects guy, who became more of a creature effects guy after that. He was the only one that transferred over to the new version, and he kind of art directed the sci-fi version. And I think, to his credit, what he helped do was help make sure that the two movies were distinctively different, the original version and this. And I think he was able to help facilitate that because I think once they decided to start it up again and change it, they didn't really want any of us from the first one involved in the sci-fi version.
Whoa.
So, yeah. So Mom and Dad Save the World was sort of like a launch point for a couple things that all switch gears.
Interesting.
In different ways. Yeah.
It's amazing production design and practical effects. I would say there's a lot of, we can go down the line of like what your effects were. It's a lot of like animatronic masks and puppets and things like that, which is pretty cool.
It was fun. I mean, it was a lot of work. So when Marge and Dick arrive, they get separated, and there's these little characters. The males are these bulldog characters, and the females are these fish characters. They meet the dogs first, and we had Ed Gale and Tony Cox in suits with padding and foam hands, and then they had animatronic heads. And we used their own eyes and contact lenses, and then the facial features were all radio controlled. We ended up shooting in a building that had all this steel rebar in the construction of it. So a lot of times the radio signals like would fry or not go through. We were trying aluminum foil and all this crazy stuff to kind of direct signals. I just remember it being very frustrating, just trying to do very basic stuff with the radio control. But Ed and Tony were great, and you know, they could see. They had complete vision other than the contact lenses. So they were the most comfortable of anybody that we put in a suit. When Marge gets taken away, she goes with some handmaidens, and those are these fish women. Debbie Carrington is Bois, the lead fish lady, and her husband is Blatt.
The lead dog.
She shows a picture of her family at one point, and she's got little bulldog boys and little fish girls, and they're barbecuing. I think they're barbecuing a giant toad that we had, or a body of a toad that we had taken from a display from Swamp Thing.
Oh my God.
That we'd done for USA Network and changed it up a little bit. And it's on a rotisserie spit. And we just did latex and polyfoam dummies of the kids and posed them with the adults for the
photo. Oh, right, because Photoshop doesn't exist.
Right, so they had to really be made, but we just made them as dummies. But the guys walking around, like I said, they had contact lenses so they could see and breathe a lot easier. And then Debbie Carrington and Lee Poppy and our third fish person, they had virtually no vision if the mouth closed, because
that fish mouth was it.
That was air and that was vision.
Oh my God, I was looking when I was watching this for where their eyes slits are. Would be to see it, and I was just like, I don't know where they built them. The thing is that they didn't.
Yeah, we tried to work them into some wrinkles around the eye so we could give them some more options to see. They just kept wanting the faces smoother, and they were lighting everything so brightly. There was really nowhere to hide things, and then the motors actually got in the way as well, because the motors for the eyes were in front as well. So we work with Debbie and Lee, and in regards to, you know,
how to walk,
function and walk. And then when we did shots, they would rehearse the shot minus the head, and then they put the head on, and we had spotters for their endpoint and stuff like that. But Debbie Carrington, fearless, just powered through stuff, and she's picking up stuff, and she just remembered where things were, and she was doing whole scenes, and you're like, you would forget that
she can't see.
She's completely blind, and if you close the mouth, she can't breathe, because wow. She was just so, so good. It was really a pleasure to watch her work.
Well, how interesting also that it's two little people who but two little people who have also worked on the Child's Play franchise. You have Ed Gale,
yeah. Uh-huh.
Who worked on the original, and probably, I should know this, but, you know, sequels, and then Debbie Carrington, who started working on them with you.
Yeah.
How funny. And this is after the first Child's Play has come out.
Yeah. Well after. Yeah. He was great. Tony Cox was great. Tony Cox went on to do Bad Santa and
so many movies.
Really funny. Very dry sense of humor.
That's cool.
And he still kept his sense of humor in that suit too.
These dogs' faces. That's my question is, so there has to be some prosthetics that are on their face and then a mask?
No, it's all animatronic, and it butts right up to a vacuform shell around their eyes, and the prosthetics glue down to that. And then there was the tiniest bit of an eye bag where if they were going to go in for an extreme close-up, it pushed against their skin, but if we wanted to glue it down, we probably could have, but then we would ruin the skin. I don't know that we ever actually glued anything down.
Wow, that's impressive.
And then we did a bunch of background fish and background dogs for all the crowd scenes, and those are just like latex Halloween masks. But the set was so hot, and these people were in all these layers of costumes and masks and stuff, We had a designated crew of people to watch over the people in the suits. And the person who was the fish people captain and the person who was the dog people captain had these big clocks around their neck on a chain well before Flavor Flav. And one said fish clock and one said dog clock. And it showed the amount of time left before we would be taking all the dogs or fish people out of their masks for a break, because the concept of time management on this was crazy because there was so much going on in so many of the big scenes. We took it on ourselves to make sure that everybody was okay.
That they got air and they got a break. That's so funny.
But even so, we still had one person
faint,
throw up. Almost pass out.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's serious business.
It is, because it's
it's taking away a lot of your senses that you're not, it takes true skills. That's so funny. I say this in every episode and then I never go find it, but I will put it in this episode. I have behind the scenes footage from Mom and Dad Save the World from my dad. I don't know if.
We have the whole edited thing. That's that thing that we did to music.
Yeah.
And then we've also got tons of photos. I think we actually have pictures of people wearing the fish clock.
No, that's what I was about to say. I was really confused in seeing some of this BTS that they shot on a camcorder, because there was fish. I definitely remember a fish clock and I was like, what does that mean? But now I know it's for so people don't die.
It's this clock means life.
Clock means life, giving life to the fishes.
Yeah.
I think it was the land of no rules from studios around that time, because just the amount of stuff that was shot from members of your team running around. One guy's just running through the tunnels that were built, and then one guy's running around in a Speedo or something like that.
Oh, we took cameras everywhere. Yeah, we were just.
It was pretty cool.
Just super casual.
It was pretty cool for something like this too, to see the behind the scenes of how the set is mapped out, and then you guys testing some of your guys' creations, these, we'll get into it later, but these evil mushroom things, there's a lot of testing how those would move and things like that. But
they parked the weird vehicles outside the set, and we would go pose and take photos.
Oh, you know what?
Driving and stuff. I think there's
on the video of too. You with some very long, luscious hair. I will say these masks are very impressive for the amount of animatronics that has to happen, because on the dogs, I noticed it's the ears have movement, the eyes have movement, and the mouth all have movement. Where do you hide the wires? How did you do that?
For the dogs, I think we had half of the motors in the head and half on a backpack. They have these sort of hunchbacks. So half the motors come off the back of the head and are in that backpack. But it was all the lips, the jaw, the eyebrows, and then the ears. So it all added up pretty quickly.
I got to say that the dog snarly bits is when the dogs go to growl or something like that. It looks really dog-like.
Yeah, Jim McPherson sculpted the dogs. He was the main dog sculptor. Did a great job with the jowls and the teeth. And then Brian Penicus did all the painting, and he added a lot to the realism of them with all the modeling around the nose and the spottiness, and it helped really bring them alive.
And for the fish ladies, I noticed that they blink, which is awesome.
Except Lee Poppy, the one with the glasses, there was no room to make her blink. So if you watch it again, if you have a reason to watch it again,
The
tallest fish does not blink. Her head was a little smaller, and she just didn't have the room inside.
To make that happen.
Yeah, her fish head was a little smaller.
I see.
So
that makes sense. I mean, covered up with some glasses. Nobody's going to question it.
So.
Except us now.
They still looked around, but they didn't blink.
I see. Did the eyes?
Their fins moved and their mouths moved.
Yeah, the fins on the side of their heads moved. Their mouths, their fish mouths opened and closed. But not only that, on the top of their heads, the fins also went down and up.
Oh, right. I forgot.
Yeah, I saw that in one of the scenes. And it just really helps be able to emote for characters that don't have eyebrows. What I've learned through my dad here is that puppets that don't have eyebrows to help emote are harder to, the emotions are harder to convey. So the more you can physically emulate an emotion helps. And at one point, Debbie Carrington's fish, the orange one, gets like sad or something about her. Bois gets sad about her relationship with Blatt. And so then her fin on the top of her head also droops. Right. And it's, you're able to understand. Yeah.
And they do a really great job with body language too to help sell it.
As a fun side note, these fish characters. So I went to film school and my.
What?
What? That's so shocking. I've never mentioned it once in my entire life. In school for my senior thesis, I wanted to do a short film about a puppet, a fish that is a puppet that goes, well, she's just, okay, let me back up. I wanted to do a story about a fish out of water that goes to school and can't really relate to others around her and has a hard time making friends. And so it was going to be a fish puppet off the bat, and my dad and his team helped bring her to life. And in the process of making it, there were all these drawings that my dad showed me of these fish people from this movie that I hadn't seen, to help us come up with the design for that fish. Her name's Phoebe. And that was part of the question of what could help her emote her feelings and what was going to be like hair and things like that. And it ended up not being a mask, and it was just a full-on rod puppet, like the Muppets, but heavier and taller and more complicated. But the blinking was really helpful, and we did do something with her top fin. It was foam. But on one of the shots, we had the rod, like, help put it down when she was sad. And so this movie, regardless of, you know, whatever of it existing long in time, this movie helped me figure out, like, my senior thesis with my dad, because there were these fish characters in it. So now I finally watched the movie, and now I get it, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and what's nice about your film was that Phoebe actually spoke English.
That's true.
So you had emotions conveyed in the dialogue.
Yes.
Whereas this one, the fish speak.
She said Blatt.
Yeah, she speaks gobbledygook mostly, but, you know, they try to put inflection in that.
Yeah, but that's hard. And then when she's crying or something, or the one of the dogs was crying, you know, he's like wiping his eyes, just really giving the physicality to it because they don't have emotion. So their English is limited.
Yeah, they understand it, but apparently can't speak it.
Yes. Yeah. So, okay. What are the rules of this planet? We don't know.
They have their own language.
They have their own language. But that was really cool to see.
But if you're a rat, you can speak English.
Oh, yeah. But then the rat speaks English, which brings us to our next point. What the heck is this? Like, who came up with a space rat? And then why does the space rat talk English? And then, like, was there originally more life for the space rat? Because it's a really great puppet that just kind of just makes an entrance and then exits.
Yeah, he was, that was one of the characters where they gave us a specific design, said this is what we want with antenna and these proportions and a long nose, sort of like Big Daddy Roth kind of vibe to the design. And he's going to be in a scene in a prison or in a jail cell. And he's sitting in the garbage and it's dark and Dick is talking and something's mimicking him and he has to figure out what it is. And then he sees it's this rat sitting in the garbage.
Come on, shoot. Get out of here.
Come on, shoot. Get out of here.
Literally parroting everything he says. Yeah. And then he scares it away. And it's gone and that's it.
That's it.
It shows up again in the very end as a last minute idea that Greg Beeman had. He's like, you know, it'd be awesome to see the space rat again. And the bottom of the throne, there's a door that opens up and he pops out. But he doesn't serve the story and isn't used in any way.
He's just there.
The way that the current version exists. I don't remember if the original version, if he did more or not.
If there was more ratage.
Yeah, or he served a story point, but the current edit, he's just there and gone.
Well, I love this rat because he serves as my inner monologue with myself, where it's just a voice mimicking every single thought I have, but just in a terrible voice back to me.
And it gives you a wardrobe.
And it gives me wardrobe. And the sad part is I already had this outfit in my closet. So I said, oh, what can I dress up that my Dad did the rat. I can be the space rat because I have a giant full-sized rat costume in my closet.
And why did you have that in your closet?
Like 2 years ago, I wanted to have my rat girl summer because I was sad. I was sad. I was not going to have a hot girl summer. So it was rat girl summer. Who knew it would last so long and just be my life at this point? But I went to the Renaissance Fair here in California as a rat because I wanted to go as the bubonic plague. So I was historically accurate and very hot.
But you were a hit.
I was a hit. And if you saw me 2 years ago, I also went again because I was in my rat girl era because I was gearing up to film a movie that I just shot, which is why we didn't have a podcast last month. But I was just so busy. I had no time. So I said, all right, I'll just pull out the rat and be a rat again at the Renaissance Fair this year. And I got so many trinkets and treasures.
From like, other people?
Yes. From somebody dressed as a crow. And
oh, nice.
The plague doctors. And then a lot of like fairy ladies gave me some things. So it was a good hit. It's just very hot. And I would like to find a costume that's less insane to wear at the Renaissance Fair. This thing is packed with so much dirt.
The costume?
Yeah. It's
great.
But I figured I could get one last usage out of it for this podcast episode.
Yeah.
Before I throw it away.
There you go.
So, but if you want a rat costume, I
call
got this.
Now.
Yes. I could also just mail it to you. Or you can get your very own at HalloweenCostumes.com. Not sponsored. This is not an ad. But anyhow, I'm the space rat. Where did that space rat go after filming? Because it was such a small puppet. I imagine you would be able to keep it, no?
A lot of that stuff like was kept by production.
Okay.
And then we were able to keep some things.
Okay.
So it was kind of random as to what ended up where. But I know we don't have any of that stuff
anymore.
No.
I do have behind the scenes footage of somebody playing football with this rat puppet.
We had a latex and polyfoam copy that was sort of like the lighting stand-in, and then we used it as a dummy in the shop as a display for a while, and then I think one of the guys at the shop's kids fell in love with the rat and he asked if he could have it.
Rightfully so.
And what are we going to do with the space rat? So after a certain amount of time, we're like, sure.
Aw. Well, I hope it got good use.
I do too.
I hope that kid has pet rat now. All grown up and has their own kids. And then their kids has rats.
And he named his kid Willard and they have an army of rats.
Ultimately, I wish the space rat had more screen time.
I do too, because it was a really cool puppet. Mark Wilson was the puppeteer and his hand was the head. So he was doing all the body stuff. And then we had legs on rods, and the arms were mechanical. Dave Penicus did these really cool slave arms that could do a lot of stuff. Then there was an animatronic tail. All the facial features were radio controlled.
Wow.
It was super elaborate. And so our hope was
that there'd be more time for it.
He would do more, but he really didn't. Yeah. It was fun to build, though.
Well, then after this encounter with the space rat, my hero, the dad goes, he tries to escape and he dresses like one of the guards and all these things, but then and eventually gets held up on both ends and has to make a getaway out of what I would assume would be a space trash chute.
Yes.
And he ends up in the sewer. And in the sewer, he encounters these weird little water mushroom creatures who seem super duper cute at first. And then they'll rip your head off.
Yeah, the idea was that the dome of the mushroom had this little like smiley mouth on it and the eyes blinked. And we kind of did it sort of like a frog where when the eyes blinked, they could also compress down into the head to keep it really sort of cute looking. But that little smile was actually their nose hole.
Oh.
So the bottom rim of the mushroom is actually where the mouth is. When the mouth opens up, it has a row of like shark teeth, basically. And then inside that first row, there's a second row of shark teeth that can kind of reach forward a little bit.
Like alien style.
Alien.
I wonder, shut it, shut up.
Yeah, and that was literally just a glove with somebody's hand inside the hollow body doing that. All the stuff on top of the head was radio controlled. And then the top of the head flipped open like a... like a trash can, basically.
Yeah.
So the lid could open up, the whole body could launch forward, and the guy inside could reach further with his hand.
Oh, cool.
Which also has shark, like a shark teeth mouth.
And that's just for the specialty, like close up when that first happens, to be able to do that.
Yeah, there's like a close up puppet and that can do all that kind of stuff. And then there are we call it the Lublub cart, because these things were called Lublubs, I assume, because that's the noise they kind of make.
They Lublub you.
Yeah. So the sewer was made as a practical set.
Crazy.
And we built this platform, basically, with all these pneumatics on it. And all these Lublub bodies were fiberglass, like as light as we could get them. And they would be mounted on this platform, which was basically sort of this honeycomb of steel on wheels. And they were all on hydraulic pistons, sort of like the things that jump up in the Haunted Mansion in the attic.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So as this thing's traveling with this giant-ass tail of hoses, because there's a bunch of Lublubs on this thing, they're all like jumping up and down. And in front of them, in the sewer set, they actually made a pit under the water in a certain area where we could get underneath water level. And that's what we used for attacking Dick. And then when the cart is rolling, we could jump in front of that and do more stuff than the stuff on the cart could. So like when the cart stops and we know we're not going to get run over, we could like work. So we had people in scuba gear basically in that water. But unfortunately, the water needed to be opaque and dirty. And the I don't know who it was exactly, made it opaque with something that wasn't conducive to good health.
No.
So people ended up with like funky rashes and stuff after shooting that
scene. No way.
Yeah.
That is not okay.
No, why isn't there a whole health issue and stuff like that?
We love
the
90s. This
is stuff on an episode that you don't... Oh, remember a lawsuit? A statute of limitations.
Remember that one time that they put shit in the water?
Remember the time they used urethane dye to dye the water that we all like sat in and a couple people went underwater in?
Oh, no.
This would be that sort of scenario. So we shot the stuff. And then a day or two later, a couple people were like, my skin's really dry and weird, and had to have some medical attention. So that's
gross.
Little side benefit from
working the Lublubs, working your rashes, working the 90s.
Yep.
Where else?
Safety was a different thing, apparently, at that time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's still happening.
Oh, sure. But, I mean, there's laws now that things can't happen.
Yes.
So.
But do they still sometimes happen? Also, yes.
It depends how honest the people are that you're working with, ultimately.
Yes. I do have a question. So I seen some behind the scenes where when the dad gets to the end of this tunnel that the Lublubs are chasing him from, and he looks down and it's a giant drop. And so he has to make this jump to a ladder that's hanging down. Is that a matte painting or no?
I don't know if it was a matte painting or a miniature, to be honest. But,
yeah. They extended the set practically. Like, it doesn't look like weird VFX at this point in time.
It's kind of nice because the archway that he's in frames him and frames the Lublubs, and it's a clean line.
Yeah.
And then they're in this cliff wall, and the archway and everything existed for real. That was the set floor that he was standing on, and then they comped him in or... into a miniature or a painted shot. I don't know what. They also had a section of ladder that hung in front of the live action Lublubs.
Yes.
That if they had just framed it a little bit higher and you couldn't see the bottoms of the Lublubs, you wouldn't notice they were all pistons and exposing their pistons as they jumped.
Yes, you can see it.
If they just framed above the feet of those things, it would have worked better. But they do use the Lublub cart in little short shots. So there is this sort of maniac look to it. And it works really well when you're seeing just glimpses of it. But once you spend any time on it, it just falls apart and you see it for what it is.
That's unfortunate. I mean, luckily, like when they jump up a little bit, you know, the water's splashing. So at least that is helpful. But that also just must be frustrating. When stuff like that happens, and I'm not saying exactly on this set, but when stuff like that happens, are you ever able to like go to the director and have a conversation like that of like, hey, I can see our piston?
Well, a lot of times we're in the heat of like puppeteering, so we don't
see
anything other than what we're doing.
Ah.
So there's no opportunity for us to offer like any input. Like, but on like Chucky, you know, we'd shoot something and then Don would play it back. And
that's good.
And then one of the puppeteers could go, could we redo that something, because we can see blah, blah, blah.
That's good.
And
it's almost like you need a like on shows where you don't have that time, it's like almost like you need a
Video playback and somebody to keep their eyes on it. And normally, like on the Chucky films, the first ones, I could be not operating something. I could be watching for everything.
Like a supervisor. Like the
right,
head.
But as the budgets got trimmed, then I become a puppeteer and then I'm watching what I'm doing and trying to keep everything else in the periphery. But I'm counting on everybody else at that point to speak up if there's something that they're not happy with.
It's a lot going on. And that's also, you know, why the teams, like you have to find the right people who also are looking out for the small details, because not everybody does. Some people, like, and I'm not saying this about anybody that you've worked with, I'm just saying like some people are there just for their paycheck and they're not looking at the small details. So no wonder like people just work with the same people again, because it's those people putting in the extra effort to make sure it goes off as well as it can.
The people that are invested and care are the ones that you want to bring back and work with the next time. That's why we've had the same puppeteers on the Chucky show for 3 seasons and the film prior to that.
Well, I know it's now it's episode to episode, but do they relatively work with the same script supervisor as well?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because that's also important.
Yeah, but we're kind of on our own as far as the puppet stuff, because script supervisors have enough
so
to do with
much
people.
To look at.
They're counting on the puppet to just
be awesome.
Yeah. And to be honest, most of the time, if you're doing a puppeteer job and you're responsible for the puppet and you bring it and it moves, everybody's happy. You can be the one to say, we missed this vowel or his eye stopped working.
And they're like, no, it looked great.
They're like, oh, it looks fine. And you have to say, no, it literally has a stroke after
mid-take.
It says, I'm going to kill you because the radio went out in the left eye. And you have to stand up for that to make sure that it looks its best. But we have everybody now like on set. It's like if something goes down, we all stop amongst our group.
Yeah.
And we all stop.
Oh.
So the whole thing dies.
That's good.
So that everything stays that way.
That's a good way to also just ensure that they don't use, because you don't know what an editor is going to pick and choose from, regardless of the note being like, the eye malfunctioned here, somebody could just still use it. So that's a great like fail safe too, to just make sure that that take's not usable because it's not what you are setting the standard for.
Yeah, and I learned that watching John Travolta work on Hairspray.
Really?
Yeah, because he's wearing that giant full body suit and all the prosthetics and a 40-pound dress, which was amazing, and a wig and all this stuff. And he's doing this dance on this stage in heels.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And he's putting, like, all his energy into making this amazing. But when it gets to the point where he felt like something could have been tighter or somebody else, you know, didn't
hit a mark was off or something.
He's watching all of it, and whenever anything happens or he's feeling anything, he does this. Because as soon as he covers his mouth, because he's singing, they can't use it. So it's like the alarm that
what
something's
a smart
gone on.
Person.
And it was like, that's brilliant, because he literally has control over what's used and what isn't used. Our whole thing, like if we think something's going south, you know, we all say stop and that's it. But if something genuinely does go wrong, that's our go-to response.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a very good note for anybody listening too, of just like how to feel like you have agency over yourself in potentially like a world that doesn't let you feel like you have control over your work all the time.
But it's important you do that too, because like if you're doing a big blood gag and let's say there's other people involved that have to be doing stuff as part of it and part of the action, and you've got it prime, but all of a sudden there's something that isn't working, we won't fake it or try and make it work. We'll call stop, because it's going to cost production more time to clean up a poorly done spray or anything else in order to like get back to the point where you were if you hadn't just called stop.
Yeah.
So it saves everybody in the end. So it's just trying to like be in charge of your own destiny in a way. It's just being responsible for your job.
Yeah.
Doing your best work and making sure that you're using time efficiently, because on set, time is money.
Goodness, don't I know it.
Yeah. Now. Once the clock starts ticking, it's all about what's the most expedient way to get what we need.
Is there any other creatures that we've missed?
There's the dead Lublub that they serve at the camp. Which is just
so sad.
Which is just a dummy. Yeah, it was like a heartbreaking little thing because they're so cute. Even though they're mean and trying to kill Dick.
They're trying to kill Dick, y'all. They're trying to kill Dick so hard.
To see it on the plate, and we sculpted the mouth. Like
sad.
The nose hole, a little like downturned, and it just looks really sad on this tray. Then the only other thing we did is Todd Spengo is sort of, there used to be this like disguise doll back in the 70s that was this bald headed blank slate guy, and you could put wigs or hats or mustaches or whatever on it. I forgot what it was
like
called.
Like on the slate, like with the magnetized beads?
No. Oh. It was an actual little doll. I think it was called Hugo or something like that. The idea with Todd Spengo was he's this blank slate of just like doughy, soft nothingness. No eyebrows, no hair, no teeth. And that he would like dress up for whatever the occasion. And that would include straight teeth or crooked teeth or bushy eyebrows or soft eyebrows.
Mutton chops or not mutton chops.
Yeah, he could just mix and match what he wanted. So John has really thick black hair. So we had to like get all that flattened down and then do a bald cap on that. And it was like the healthiest hair I think I've ever had to put a bald cap on. And one of the first times I ever did a bald cap, we did a big foam one. And we had to pull it down so hard and tight to get all that hair to look smooth. Thank God his costume had this big high collar, because the base of his neck at a certain point of the day would get a little leathery looking.
Yeah.
And the collar helped hide that for us. But then they'd have him do push-ups. And it's like, oh, hey, you know, how's that base of the neck look today? But John Lovitz was a really good sport. And he had these dentures that looked like he was toothless. So it looks just like gums. And then he had teeth that he could, like rows of teeth that he could put over top of that. And then we made dental veneers that had different looks to them. And then we made one set of veneers that actually matches his real teeth. So that if he grabbed that and went to put it in and they cut, then his hand's here and he takes it away, revealing his real teeth. And voila.
Voila, he has teeth.
Yep.
He has teeth. He has purse.
Those were the main things, really, on that show.
That's your first bald cap, like on film?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a good bald cap.
Yeah, I think how we did it in foam, you know? Because we could make it thick and dense to help us hold all that hair down. Yeah. Nowadays, you probably put 3 dots on somebody and...
3 dots and boom, bald.
Yeah.
In post production.
Digitally, do whatever you want. Yeah.
No, we keep things practical on this.
All these characters would have been digital, probably.
Which breaks my heart because it's so much cooler when you can see people interacting with it.
Yeah. Although with shows like The Mandalorian now, people are starting to embrace practical stuff again, which is really.
Yeah, like really that nice sweet spot between where CGI helps enhance what they're doing practically.
Right.
This is a random side note, but I just wonder, because there's so much animatronics of like head work in this film and like hiding of battery packs. Do you think that this helped you when you guys went to go do Daft Punk's helmets?
It gave us the basic concept of putting everything on their backs in a pack.
I see.
For sure. But I think it helped us the most when we went to do Warriors of Virtue, because those heads were really tight to the actors' heads and there was no room. So everything really was on their backs.
Oh, wow. Interesting. It's interesting how one thing helps you on another
project. Well, you keep learning and then figure out how to, you know, adapt what you've learned. If it's useful, you know, use that same knowledge for something else.
My dad always tells me to write everything down, which is what I should probably do after what I've experienced on my feature film that I just shot, of just remembering what was helpful or something that could be improved. Or
a lot of times something that's a mistake now is something that you can use as reference in the future for something else. And I learned that Dick Smith did a bunch of polyfoam. Dick Smith is a famous makeup effects artist who did The Exorcist and The Godfather and really pioneered all of modern makeup effects. And he was working on something where he was doing polyfoam casting. He was mixing, he mixed stuff incorrectly and he got some ratios wrong, but he'd written down what he'd done. The stuff, it cast okay, and then it sort of withered and got weird. And then after a certain amount of time, it was really easy to like crumble and fall apart. He's like, well, that's a failure, but kept the notes. Mm-hmm. And then when he was doing The Hunger with David Bowie, later, there's all these mummies that come alive. They start to like fall and break and crumble and stuff. And he's like, where's that formula that was a failure 15 years ago? Because that's perfect for what we're doing now. And he said that he pulled that out and they fine tuned the failure to create something that worked really well as a practical effect that happened live on camera.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, write it all down and you never know what you could use again or how you could use it again.
Yeah, that's but true.
The other reason to write it down is because, you know, if you can't remember anything,
then what good is it?
It's good to have.
Well, do you have anything to add for Mom and Dad Save the World, like a favorite memory from set or anything like that?
I was a huge Monty Python fan, so hanging out in the jail cell with Eric Idle and talking with him was great.
Yeah.
And really enjoyable. And I also love Young Frankenstein. So I got to hang out with Terry Garr a couple times, once in the throne room, when she's in that whole crazy get out, just having a casual conversation. Just both of them, just the loveliest, nicest people, and
that's
some
so
really
cool.
good memories. And Dwyer Brown had just been in Field of Dreams as the dad that comes out of the field and plays ball with Kevin Costner. So he was considered sort of magical at the time because that was such a magical scene. And it was nice to meet him and realize that he was this really great down-to-earth guy. I think we did t-shirts as wrap gifts for everybody.
That's sweet.
Yeah, and Kathy Ireland actually sent a card saying thank you. And it's like just everybody on this show is just a really nice person, no matter what their level of success in whatever different thing they were doing, and just really nice to be with. So
that's really nice.
Yeah,
because that doesn't happen on every movie.
No, for sure. And everybody, even the people that were in the extra
dog
fish costumes and stuff, we're still friends with because everybody was so nice. We were in this crazy experience together and we all bonded. And we all saw the humor in it through the whole experience, no matter how crazy it got, which is easier once it's over, obviously. And then, just good human beings.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
I'd be curious if there's still a cut out in the world that's the raunchy version that could have been super funny.
If anybody has access to Greg Beeman's original cut, if Greg Beeman has it, put it out. Because it was really great.
The people want to know. Yeah. I want to know how many more dick jokes were in this movie.
Oh, Greg has such a great sense of humor, and his timing on some of that stuff was so good. So to see it go away.
Was it mainly like dialogue that was cut out, cut around?
Well, there were some scenes and some weird actions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
John Lovitz had a bunch of really weird stuff. That's all gone.
It's interesting because you can see him kind of go for it more in other scenes than others. And it made me question kookier of stuff that he did that probably got cut. So that makes sense.
I mean, the bottom line is all those people are there because they were attracted to the script.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that any of us got paid a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Because most of the money went to the production design and the stuff.
Well, it just wasn't a big budget movie. So everybody was there because they loved the script. So just know that if you can get your hands on the original script too.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be interesting to read that and see what the difference is.
Interesting. You know? Well, the good thing is I don't think it killed anyone's career. Well, thank you for coming to another episode of the Flesh and Blood and Bone podcast. We will continue onward in our quest. And maybe
pick another film.
Yeah, pick another film. Start diving into music videos, maybe. I don't know. We were kind of talking about Daft Punk's helmets in this one, and I wonder, just diving into like stuff like that of creating Daft Punk's helmets would be cool.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll talk about that next, and it'll give you something to look forward to. And as always, please follow us, like, and subscribe, all those fun things on all our social media. I'll put them down below. That's a wrap on Rat Kira. That's a wrap on the rat.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching or listening.
Thanks for watching or listening. Bye.
Bye.